So, let's begin the course proper. First, a prologue. I've said some of this by giving you the history of the course. Let me make a comment about the term Marxism. I prefer to refer to the Marxist tradition rather than Marxism as a way of thinking about the body of ideas that we'll be exploring. There's really a problem naming an intellectual tradition after a person when you think about it. First of all, it privileges the work of that person. It says somehow the founder of an intellectual tradition has a special place, not merely historically as the point of departure for a body of ideas, but as an authoritative statement of those ideas. So that you have to justify energetically any revisions. Indeed, in the Marxist tradition, the term revisionism has been used as a negative way of talking about changes in the intellectual structure, the ideas. It's a way of attacking somebody as departing from true Marxism. Well, that whole way of thinking about it is inimical to a scientific approach to developing an understanding of society. It's really anti-science to say that revisionism is a problem. What science is constantly seeking to do is to revise. That's the whole point. The whole point is to not arrogantly assume that you know the answer to everything before you've studied them. It's that you know that you don't know the answers to everything. You know that the ideas you have must have flaws in them. How could they not? And the whole point of scientific endeavor is to challenge and improve and revise. So Marxism brings with it a whole liability, the term Marxism. As I think I commented in some of the notes in the syllabus, Darwinism in evolutionary biology is a term used by creationists who want to treat scientific evolutionary biology as just another doctrine. They believe in creationism, other people believe in evolutionary biology. These are just two beliefs. They have the same epistemological standing, whereas, of course, that's not the case. Creationism is non-science, and evolutionary biology is a deeply scientific effort to understand the evolution of species. So I think the Marxist tradition softens that a little. It still would be better if we had a good name for this tradition that wasn't named after a person. Marx, at one point in his own life, said in French, "Je ne suis pas un Marxiste," I am not a Marxist, because he himself was uncomfortable with the idea that the theoretical positions which he was taking were named after him. This is not a course on Marx. It's indeed not even really a course on the development of this body of ideas. Rather, it's a course on the logic, concepts, and theories that I think represent the best and most developed and productive ways of thinking through the problems that define the terrain of this tradition. Now, the fact of the matter is, for better or worse, this tradition is called Marxism. I will use the term Marxism a lot during the semester. It's just simpler than constantly having circumlocutions to get around using the term. I describe myself as a Marxist sociologist. That's the way the world identifies people who are located within this intellectual tradition. So I don't want to be too precious about this and have us, you know, worry about how we're using these terms. I just want to alert you to my stance towards it. It's also, for better or worse, a fact of the intellectual traditions in this tradition that many debates that are serious and thoughtful and deep debates on issues take the form of debates about Marx. I think that's unfortunate. I think it's much better to debate ideas in their own right and defend them rather than to debate them via examining texts and arguing about what's really being said. But nevertheless, that's the way this tradition developed for interesting historical reasons. So there are times where we will be reading things which are about Marx. Most notably, at the end of the semester, we will read significant parts of Jerry Cohen, G.A. Cohen's book, Karl Marx's Theory of History of Defense, in which that book is a very detailed, rigorous reconstruction of Marx's own texts on history as in an attempt to produce a coherent account of what that theory of history is like. It's a fantastic book, I think, one of the best pieces of writing ever done in the Marxist tradition, but it does take this form of an analysis of texts. And that will have, there'll be various other things we'll be reading that will have that form. Okay. My relationship to the material. Well, I've already said something about that. I consider myself, my work, as not simply embedded in the Marxist tradition. I have tried throughout my intellectual career to contribute to that tradition, in particular to contribute to reconstructing it. I have seen as, you know, to the extent that one has a mission in one's academic life, my mission has been to render the core concepts within the Marxist tradition relevant to contemporary problems and rigorous in their scientific content. What that has meant is that I've been in constant dialogue with non-Marxist currents, and including some that are even anti-Marxist, or at least hostile to Marxism or ignore Marxism altogether. My work is in, I draw in my work on feminism, analytical philosophy, even neoclassical economics, certainly Weberian sociology, and just ordinary sociology. And I don't see any problem in that. I think it's disabling one's theoretical capacities to imagine that by drawing ideas from other traditions, one is somehow infecting a radical emancipatory tradition with anti-emancipatory elements which will ultimately corrode its emancipatory potential. I just think that's nonsense. That's just... That I used to have to defend this. I don't find that I have to defend this so much. By the way, this is just a slightly side. So over the years, the things which students who take this course bring to the course has changed. There were times in the 1980s where I had absolutely diehard revolutionary, you know, committed revolutionary students who were members of various kinds of sectarian political parties and formations and would bring all the battles which they're waging in their activist life to bear on the class. And so I would say things to preempt some unnecessary squabbles. And of course, if you teach the same course and it evolves over time, the shadows of those previous encounters continue to linger in the way you approach things. And so sometimes I'll say things that have no relevance whatsoever to anybody in the class now. You know, so probably, I don't know, to make the statement, it's a good thing to revise Marxism, isn't shocking to anybody in the class here. Did anybody find that a kind of an abrupt statement that indicated that I was off the true path? Of course, I'm asking the question in a way that it would be tough for anybody to say, yes, I thought that. But there was a time when if I said something like that, there'd be people who would object to it, you know, who would argue with
me
about it.
Call you a heretic.
What?
Call you a heretic or something.
Yeah, who would just say I'm drifting into bourgeois thinking, and that was the rhetoric of the way. And so since my intellectual formation was forged in a world where I had to defend what came to be known as analytical Marxism against what I would call dogmatic Marxists, they would call true Marxists. Those battles shape the way I then present my material, and occasionally then I will try to preempt points of disagreement when it's not at all necessary in the world today. Although when I present this material in New York, there are places in the United States where it's still the case. If I present this kind of material, I will confront exactly this sort of stuff, very familiar from the 1970s. Okay, many Marxisms. So if once we begin to think of Marxism as a tradition of thought rather than as a doctrine, then it becomes just immediately obvious that it's an extremely diverse and heterogeneous tradition with many different currents. Just to give you some names to attach to some of these currents, there's Hegelian Marxism, humanist Marxism, cultural Marxism, structuralist Marxism, orthodox Marxism, not to mention Marxisms associated with particular traditions, Marxism-Leninism, Maoist Marxism, Trotskyist Marxism, etc., etc. You could elaborate the list in many different ways. If this was a course on the Marxist tradition as such, part of the task would be to draw lines of demarcation to familiarize students with the central ideas that differentiate one strand of this intellectual tradition from others. What does it mean to be a structuralist Marxism as opposed to a humanist Marxism? Marxist humanism was a very big deal in the 1960s and 70s, and it was in constant battle with what came to be known as structuralist Marxism. Well, we'd want to really work on those currents and establish their demarcations. We're not going to do that in this class. It's not that it's a bad thing to do. I think actually it's intellectually quite interesting to think about lines of demarcation that matter and lines of demarcation that have purely symbolic purposes, that are doing work other than clarifying how the world works. That would be a course in the sociology of knowledge or the history of ideas, and there just isn't time to do that and to deal with what I consider to be the best work with the most interesting concepts and debates around all the topics we want to try to grapple with. The center of gravity of the work we'll be exploring is what has come to be known as analytical Marxism. That's a term that was coined in the mid-1980s. It grew out of a group of Marxist-inflected scholars. There were 12 of us, and I would say initially probably 8 would have self-identified as Marxist and 4 would have self-identified as friendly to Marxism. This was a group of scholars that has been meeting every year since 1979. We continue to meet. I was invited to the group in 1981, so I wasn't there at the very beginning. It began as a discussion group organized by G.A. Cohen, this Marxist philosopher eventually at Oxford. He was at University College London at that time. Canadian-born analytical philosopher who wrote this extraordinary book, Karl Marx's Theory of History, A Defense, published in 1979. I wrote a review of the book for New Left Review, just for a little bit of anecdotal history. My wife and I adopted a baby in Costa Rica in 1979, and we were stuck in Costa Rica for 10 weeks because of the need to finalize the adoption there and get a Costa Rican passport for the baby before we could get a visa to bring the baby back with us to the U.S. And that took 10 weeks. So we were in Costa Rica with this wonderful little baby who recently made me a grandfather. while I was there, I read Jerry's book, was blown out of the water by it, and wrote this review of the book, which was eventually published in New Left Review. Jerry liked my review and invited me then to come to this meeting to discuss the concept of exploitation. And that group has been meeting every year, occasional lapses, but basically every year since then. Other names of people in the book, in the group that we'll be reading in the course of the semester are Adam Shavorsky, John Romer, Jan Elster, Robert Brenner, Philippe von Paris, and a number of other people. Initially, it was all men. We worried obsessively about that. I mean, we did not take it for granted that this was a boys' club. And indeed, it caused us a lot of anguish because the particular style of the discussions were incredibly intense. Not an outsider would have thought it was aggressive, but that's not how it was experienced. The inner life of the group was not that we were aggressive towards each other. We were just relentless in finding the weaknesses in each other's arguments. And our feeling was that that was necessary in order to really push our analyses to the finest analytical precision, was to subject it to people who were really good at finding flaws. But that creates a certain amount of intensity, as you can imagine. That also turns out to be, in our culture, a masculinist way of engaging in debate. It's something that men in that era, in any rate, cultivated. And women scholars, equally as smart and committed to the issues, were less comfortable with that style of intellectual exchange. Now, the fact that it was masculine doesn't inherently make it undesirable. The fact that the culture trains people in different modes of argument is a fact of the way the world works. But it's a separate matter whether it's a good or bad way of developing argument. It could be, and I believe it is, part of the process by which you really do push things forward as best, as far as you can. Well, for better or worse, it meant that for the first decade or so of the group, it was an all-boys club. But we have remedied that over the years, and now we're, I suppose, because there's historical legacies, Jerry Cohen died, unfortunately, 8 years ago, and a couple of guys have left the group, so we've gradually increased our density of women. I suppose it's now 40% women and 60% men. That's just historical, rambling anecdote. So analytical Marxism is going to be the center of gravity. Not everything we read will be by people who identify with that. Yeah?
Why did Adam Czaworski leave the collective?
So Adam Czaworski left around 1990, left the collective, and he wrote a very funny letter of farewell. He said, this group was founded to explore all the core concepts of Marxism and interrogate them relentlessly to rid them of bullshit. The group called itself the Non-Bullshit Marxism Group, the NBSMG. That's its self-designation. To the world, we're the Analytical Marxist Group, but we call ourselves the No-Bullshit Marxism, the Non-Bullshit Marxism Group. And he said that we have attacked all the main concepts, we've rid them of their bullshit, but Marxism without bullshit isn't as much fun, and he felt that our work was largely done. Now, what's happened since then, actually, is that most of the papers that are presented in our annual meetings by members, most of them are not particularly Marxist. They're working on whatever problems they happen to be working on. When I present papers, it's probably the most Marxist of any of the papers presented. So the group has just drifted slowly into a more open-ended, egalitarian, social justice-oriented group of philosophers, I guess I'm the only sociologist, political scientists, historians, economists. So that's why Czaworski just had other things he'd rather spend his time on. Okay. Number five, learning the language of Marxism. A lot of what we do in this class is define concepts. We define concepts, we build theories with those concepts, we'll be doing some empirical and historical discussions. Occasionally we'll do what is called meta-theory, that is philosophical issues that bear on social theory, meta-theory. But at the heart of the course are concepts. They're the building blocks. I think the way to think about it, concepts aren't just when you define and work on a concept, you're not just defining a word, although you are doing that. You're trying to define a building block within a theoretical structure. Now, just as in learning a new language, the beginnings are always tough. You know, you can't read a dictionary until you know a language. But a dictionary is where all the words in the language are defined. So it's very tough when you begin a language. And all of you who have learned foreign languages know there's a point at which suddenly the pieces begin to fit together enough that you can begin to look up words in a dictionary. There's a point at the beginning where you can't do it. You know, if you're completely unfamiliar with a language, you can't look up a word in a dictionary of that language because you can't read the definition. But you get enough pieces and then suddenly you cross a threshold and the language begins to make sense. Well, that's a bit what we face here. We're going to be exploring a host of interesting, complex concepts. Concept like exploitation. Or a concept like the capitalist state. That is state modified by an adjective, capitalist. Interesting concept, capitalist state. Concepts around ideology, mystification, hegemony, reification. These are highfalutin concepts, difficult concepts. Those are the building blocks of theory. The concepts get their meaning in part from how they function in the theory, but you can't build the theory without the concepts. And it's that recursive character, the way in which concepts get their meaning from the theories in which they function, but you can't lay out the theory without the concepts. That's what makes it tough when you first enter a theoretical space. My advice is basically patience. Not to worry too much. Some of the things you'll read early on in the semester will be really easy to read by the end of the semester. For some of you this won't be a problem because you will already have been exposed to this vocabulary enough that even though we'll be working on the concepts and refining them a lot, moving way beyond the primitive definitions that one often has at the beginning, for some of you it'll be easygoing. You'll know what it means when you first encounter the words like capital, as used in the Marxian sense. For other people in the class, a lot of this will be quite strange initially, but just relax. Just relax. Like when you learn a language for the first time. Let it wash over you. Read it, note the things you don't understand, and it'll become easier as we go along. I used to begin the class with Jerry Cohen's book because I think it's so interesting, and so much of the rest of the class is a kind of criticism. It's a kind of criticism of the theory of history as laid out by Cohen. Not because I think Cohen got it wrong. I think he absolutely nails it, what the Marxist theory of history is. But I don't think the Marxist theory of history is the most vibrant and important part of Marxism that's relevant to the world today. And a lot of the course is a kind of commentary on that problem. The problem with Jerry's book is it's really tough. It's a really hard book to begin with. He's an analytical philosopher, and the character of a really good analytical philosopher is that they worry about every single precise detail of an argument. Which means that it's very hard to read it quickly. You have to read it carefully, piece by piece. And a lot of students just found Jerry's book just too hard to get through. And it kind of set the wrong tone for the class to begin with the hardest thing we're going to read. So I stuck it at the end of the class instead of at the beginning. And I think it works better that way. Even though logically, in a way, it belongs at the beginning. But just be patient. It's a language course. And you'll learn the language of Marxism of the Marxist tradition by the time we're done. All right. Roman numeral 2. Emancipatory social science. There are a lot of different ways, a lot of different terms that are used to describe the really big picture. The kind of theory that we'll be exploring this semester. The kind of theory of which Marxism is one current. So the Marxist tradition is only one tradition within an even bigger umbrella. Sometimes this is called critical theory. Other times, radical theory. you know, it depends upon the historical moment whether the term radical connotes something on the left or on the right, but that term was used in the past. I have used the term emancipatory social science more recently. In my book, Envisioning Real Utopia, I settled on that term as the overarching term. Sometimes I add an additional term and call it critical emancipatory social science, but that gets a little too cumbersome. So I've come to use the term emancipatory social science. This shouldn't be used as a restrictive term. It's really meant to be an encompassing way of imagining a theoretical space within which we develop different bodies of ideas to tackle different domains of problems. So let me begin by giving you what I think of as the foundations of what this is all about. I'll give you a couple of foundational propositions. First, of a critical plus emancipatory plus social plus science in general, and then of the Marxian variant. So the foundational proposition of a critical social science is the following. Many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing are the result of existing institutions and social structures. It's a pretty simple proposition. Kind of seems almost trivial when you say it out loud. Many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing are the result of existing institutions and social structures. That's what it means to be a critical social scientist, is that you believe it's the case that our institutions are not merely to be described and explained, but they're to be criticized by virtue of the fact that they're responsible for many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing. That's what I would describe as the foundational claim of all critical perspectives. The foundational claim of an emancipatory social science is transforming those institutions and structures has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibility for human flourishing. It's a kind of complement. You can see it's a complementary point, but it's not a simple corollary. It doesn't follow necessarily that even if our institutions are responsible for many forms of suffering, that transforming those institutions could reduce suffering. And that's because there are costs to transformation. And it could be that the knock-on effects of transformation, of the process of transformation, creates so much harm that transforming institutions makes things worse. The cure can be worse than the disease, to use a common aphorism. You know, this is obvious when you think about the human body. Many forms of human suffering are the result of malfunctions of our bodies in one way or another. But it isn't necessarily the case that actually trying to transform our bodies would reduce the suffering. It depends upon the nature of the problem and the costs of the transition, the cost of transformation. I will be arguing throughout the semester for an emancipatory social science. That is, I'll be arguing on this very difficult but crucial claim that fundamental transformations of our institutions indeed can significantly reduce human suffering and expand the potential for human flourishing. That's the emancipatory claim of Marxism. It's the emancipatory claim of feminism. It's the emancipatory claim of critical race theories. It's the emancipatory claim of all theories that attempt to make the world a better place. The Marxian variant, then, of this broader emancipatory social science just adds some specificity to the claims. So the general foundational claim of critical social science didn't say what it was about those institutions that are responsible for the many forms of suffering and the deficits in human flourishing. It just said institutions are responsible. Well, that's a pretty cheap thing to say if you don't have to say what it is about institutions. Feminists would say Many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing are the result of existing patriarchal characteristics. If the word patriarchy is the term being used to describe the gender-specific forms of oppression. The Marxian variant says many forms of human suffering and many deficits in human flourishing in the world today are the result of the class structure and dynamics of capitalism. What it means to be a Marxist critical theorist of the world today is to identify class and capitalism as sources of human suffering and deficits in human flourishing. That's not all it means, but it means that. That's the core foundational critical thesis. And the core foundational emancipatory thesis is transcending capitalism by creating a democratic, egalitarian political economy has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibilities for human flourishing. Transcending capitalism by creating a democratic, egalitarian alternative. Democracy and equality, I think, are the two pivots. I think there's a third component to solidarity, which we'll discuss. Has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibilities for human flourishing. Now, that way of formulating the emancipatory thesis doesn't say anything about how you transcend capitalism. It doesn't say whether this is through a revolutionary break or reformist, you know, tinkering or what. It's silent on the actual process. It's just a claim that if you could transcend capitalism in this direction towards a more egalitarian and democratic alternative, this has the potential to reduce human suffering and expand the possibilities of flourishing. Yeah.
I'm wondering why it's phrased in like the weak thesis and that it has the potential to reduce as opposed to like a hard thesis.
Yeah, so that was me hedging a little. So, by the way, these are my formulations. These don't have any canonical standing. This is my attempt to make sense. Okay, so when I sat down to write this out, I thought, okay, transcending capital, yeah, I got that right. By creating democratic, got to get democracy and equality in there, democratic, egalitarian, let's stick political before economy just to expand the scope a little bit, has the will reduce human suffering. Will reduce, am I that confident? Is it, you know? It's a way of leaving more up for grabs in the theoretical elaboration rather than building it into the foundation itself. I'm confident that transcending capitalism in a democratic egalitarian direction has that potential. I'm really confident about that. That I would put very high credibility in. The prediction that it actually achieves it, there's so many contingencies involved that I'm just more hesitant to build it into the foundational claim. Yeah, Dorothy.
I want clarification on the word transcending.
Yeah.
Does it mean make changes based on the capitalistic system? And how is it different from other terms, like transforming?
Okay, so transcending means going beyond. Transforming could still be capitalism. You could transform capitalism from one type of capitalism to another. You still transformed capitalism. So it is transforming. You know, we are transforming capitalism into something else when we transcend capitalism. The word transcend means go beyond. There's a kind of religious use of the term transcendence, meaning to go beyond the physical realities of life. So there's a kind of spiritual transcendence. That's a term. I don't know if the term's origins come from religious, spiritual, theological discussions or not. It may. That may be, in fact, what transcendent. Sometimes transcendent means kind of supreme, like transcendent beauty. It means the very pinnacle of, but it also has this implication of going beyond just mere beauty. It's somehow capturing the essence and going beyond is the idea of the word transcendence. So it is transformation, it's a form of transformation, but which points beyond the existing structures.
So transcending capitalism by creating a democratic, egalitarian political economy. When we achieve creating a democratic, egalitarian political economy? Is it still capitalistic?
Well, we'll get into these complexities a lot at the end of the semester. That's the central puzzle and problem of my book that I'm writing, How to Be an Anti-Capitalist for the 21st Century. My central idea there is transcending means going beyond capitalism. So you have non-capitalist, democratic, egalitarian alternatives. But capitalism can still play a role. It doesn't mean abolishing capitalism. It doesn't mean obliterating it. It means subordinating and subjecting capitalism to the imperatives of a democratic, egalitarian world. So rather than having our democratic and egalitarian niches of economic and social relations always having to adapt to capitalism and being constrained by the structures of capitalism, the jokey way I say it is capitalism between consenting adults, as long as they do it in private, is probably okay. It's capitalism would occupy a space in the total economic structure, but a space defined by democratic, egalitarian, and solidaristic principles. And not just principles, but relations, actual institutions that impose that constraint on capitalism. The problem of how to be an anti-capitalist for the 21st century, as we will discuss, is the difficulty of figuring out exactly how such institutions could work and how to get there. You know, there's both the problem of clarifying the nature of the destination and clarifying the problem of getting from here to there. Other questions at this point? Okay. These foundational claims, I think we can regard as the point of departure. This is what we want to accomplish. We want to accomplish a social scientific theory, not just a speculative philosophy, but a real social scientific theory, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a moment, that is consistent with these two foundational claims, that builds on them and gives them specificity. They're too abstract and too vague to do us much good. They don't tell us much about the problems and dilemmas we'll encounter and what we can do about them. Central goals of an emancipatory social science. So I define this in the beginning of my book, Envisioning Real Utopias. Let me just read the passage. I don't generally read much text from books and the like in the course, but I worked really hard on trying to get this statement just right. So let me just read the passage from Envisioning Real Utopias. Emancipatory social science seeks to generate scientific knowledge relevant to the collective project of challenging various forms of human oppression. To call it a form of social science, rather than simply social criticism or social philosophy, implies that it recognized the importance of systematic scientific knowledge about how the world works for this task. To call it emancipatory is to identify a central moral purpose in the production of knowledge, the elimination of oppression and the creation of the conditions for human flourishing. And to call it social implies a belief that human emancipation depends upon transformation of the social world, not just the inner life of persons. Reflexivity. Let me introduce another key idea that bears on the tasks at hand. There is one generally important element of social theory of the sort we'll be discussing that sometimes seems pretty obscure to people. It goes under many terms, but I think reflexivity, a theory that is reflexive, is one way of using it. For the record, when you have words like this with an X in them, it's signaling that you're really sophisticated, right? You know, reflexive, right? Why not reflective? Reflexive sounds really sophisticated. I tend to try to avoid using words that really mean the same as simpler words just because they have that aura of sophistication. In this particular case, there has come to be a sufficient specificity to the use of the X version of reflexive, that I think it's okay. You know, it's not wandering into the morass of unnecessary jargon. Reflexivity, when a theory is reflexivity, it sees itself as part of the process of creating the emancipatory conditions. That the theory is part of the process by which emancipation becomes possible. The point of emancipatory social science is not just to study the world, but to create a theory that's capable of contributing to the process of bringing about fundamental transformation. This is a general feature of emancipatory social theory, not just of Marxism. Feminism sees itself as part of the process by which gender transformation takes place. Feminism as a social theory attempting to diagnose the nature of the oppression of women in particular and gender inequalities more generally, feminism sees itself as an intervention in the world, as part of the process of raising the consciousness of people in ways that enable them to combat those inequalities and those forms of oppression. Now, as soon as a theory understands that it plays a role in the world, and therefore it has to theorize its own place in the world, not just the world itself, things get really messy. Right? The theory is part of the world it studies. Now, this, of course, isn't just true for radical theories. Neoclassical economics affects the world. But neoclassical economics doesn't study the way in which neoclassical economics affects the world. Right? Economists treat the world as independent of its theories of the world, and it's just trying to understand and analyze how the world works without understanding that its own theories become part of the world which it studies. The particular form of capitalism in which we live in now is in significant ways shaped by the economic theories of capitalism. Neoliberalism as a particular doctrine that has affected public policy, that has shifted the weight, center of gravity of political interventions from one form to another, et cetera, all this stuff is not simply the result of economic theory, but it's surely been affected by neoclassical theory. Well, Marxism is that. Marxism also plays a role in the world, but unlike economics, it attempts to understand how it plays a role in the world. Now, this opens up a whole range of problems. And one of them bears directly on the next item in the agenda, the meaning of science. And here's the problem. What if it were the case that the kind of theory that would most advance emancipatory possibilities was dogmatic and rigid and inflexible? That is a theory of how the world works that would be inculcated in people as an inspirational, motivational dogma. But that's the kind of theory we need in order to get people to engage in the kinds of struggles needed to transform the world. Well, that creates a real problem for a scientific Marxism, right? If our scientific theory says that the kind of theory we need people to believe in is not a scientific theory, but a quasi-religious theory, what people need to do is to hold Marxism as a strong encompassing ideology rather than as a source of continual inquiry and revision and skepticism, well, then you have a deep internal contradiction within the theory itself that's generated by its reflexivity. Do you see that issue? Now, that is a tension which has characterized the Marxist tradition from the start. Once it became a political force. You know, I don't know what moment to announce this. Marxism was a pretty marginal, niche-y kind of thing in much of the 19th century. We now think of, the Communist Manifesto as this it's a fantastic piece of literature and that it changed the world. Well, actually, it was published, a few people read it, and it was pretty much forgotten. I mean, it didn't really play much of a role in 19th century struggles until later in the century, you know, not when it was written, for sure. Marxism really only became important once communist parties were formed and revolutionary movements embodied this as their doctrine. But it became important in those movements, not in its scientific form, as a source of continual skepticism and provisional formulation, but as doctrine. And that's then the deep tension, I think, between science and ideology in Marxism. And it reflects the fact that Marxism plays this double role in the world. On the one hand, it's a social scientific analytical framework defining a set of problems that are of crucial importance, for which there are many possible answers, and in which only research and continual inquiry and debate will push the ideas forward, and in which, as an essential part of any science, all conclusions should be regarded as provisional and subject to transformation rather than as certainties. That's Marxism as social science. And then there's Marxism as inspirational revolutionary ideology that gives people the courage to make the kinds of sacrifices that the struggles for transforming capitalism require. The prediction, the common claim in sort of Marxian language, that the certain struggles are on the side of history, that expression, you know, that points in a teleological way, that is, there's an end of history that can be known in advance, that gives people courage. Our struggles are not in vain if we know, even if we lose, we're still contributing to some grand arc of history that's pointing towards an emancipatory future. That feature of the Marxist tradition, that we know in advance the destination, not merely as an ideal, but as an actual prediction, is what I think gives, in some contexts, movements the added robustness of commitment. It's one of the reasons why religiously motivated social movements have such robust commitment. They have robust commitment because of the levels of certainty with which they believe the whole complex of ideas that fit together. Well, that's the antithesis of science. That's not just the antithesis, it's actually the enemy of science. It prevents open scientific debate and inquiry. And that, I think, is one of the big dilemmas in the Marxist tradition. It's reflexive. It wants to understand its own role in history, but in a sense it discovers by studying its own role and thinking about its own role in history that a certain kind of theory other than itself as a science might play the most mobilizing role in history. Yeah.
So I think we're using the term reflexive here to refer to a theory that reflects on its own role in the world, but I think we sometimes hear this other use of the term that means a theory that might reflect on its own epistemological status or conditions. Do you think those uses have anything to do with each other necessarily or no? Is it just a funny feature?
Well, that's an interesting, you're absolutely right. The term reflexive is also meant to be self-conscious of your own foundations, and particularly your own foundations as they are socially constructed, not just your own foundations in the sense of the logical structure of your ideas. So the epistemological point is more about being conscious of your philosophical roots, but there's also being reflexive about your social foundations. Yeah. I mean, it does seem like there's a connection between those two, but they are different points. They are different points. One is about the sources of the ideas, and the other is about the effects of the ideas as they play themselves out in the world. The point you raise, though, is another point I wanted to make about the problem of scientific objectivity. What do I exactly mean when I'm talking about science? I'm steadfast in saying that the aspiration is for Marxism to be a social science, real science, not phony science, not bullshit science, but to be as scientific as possible. What does that mean? There is a strong critique of this sort of view. It's sometimes called standpoint epistemologies, as in the feminist tradition, particularly Dorothy Smith has formulated this criticism of Marxism by saying that all knowledge is situated and positional, and that Marxism has been largely produced by European men, and it reflects their standpoint. Now, this is a really tricky issue, and it's fraught with sensitive questions. I agree entirely with this, with what I would call a sociology of knowledge point that's being made in this complicated way with the expression standpoint epistemology. There is a sociology of knowledge point, that one's social position creates biases and perspectives. How could it not? That's certainly true. And furthermore, that some kinds of knowledge, some kinds, but not all knowledge, but some kinds of knowledge require direct experience and reflection on that experience in order to really grasp that knowledge. Our own lives and lived experiences are themselves pivotal forms of empirical evidence for our social theory. Whatever else you build your social theory on, you build it on the basis of what you yourself have experienced. To the extent that the meanings people subjectively hold are socially consequential, we all have meanings and subjectivities and identities, and these are consequential. Access to knowledge about meanings is heavily shaped by your position. All of that's true. This, however, I think should be regarded as a simple causal argument about the difficulty of gaining relevant observations and thus knowing what the relevant questions are if one's position is radically different from another's position. But all this means is that we have a very difficult task of translation and empathic bridges in order to really understand the meanings of that are carried in the subjectivities of people whose lives are very, very different from ours. So this is a very important point for certain kinds of knowledge, knowledge about subjectivities, identities, meanings. And, for example, I feel I have very little understanding of the subjectivity of people who voted for Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary and then Trump in the general election. I don't get it. I mean, I don't have an empathic understanding of the kind of subjectivity that they have, which would make sense of those of that combination. Now, I can sort of have, you know, I read about it, I have a little bit of inkling as to how that could work, but I don't really deeply understand what it's like to be the kind of person for whom that makes sense. I just don't. I don't really have a good feeling for what it means to be the kind of person who believes in the literal interpretation of the Bible. You know, that really believes the world was created in 6 days or 7 days by an omniscient God, and that Adam and Eve isn't a mythical parable, it's a description of what actually happened. I don't have an empathic bridge to that kind of thinking. Well, that's positionality writ large. But that's because it bears on a very specific kind of knowledge, knowledge about internal subjectivities. Now, if you believe that subjectivity is everything, that all social explanations are ultimately just explanations about subjectivity, then standpoint epistemologies become the dominant way you would think about social explanation, because all social explanation is explaining the internal subjective states. Well, this certainly is not what the Marxian tradition argues. It argues that there are real structures with real power relations, with real institutions that constrain people regardless of what their subjectivities are. You know, there are things that happen by virtue of the power of finance capital and its ability to move its capital around the world that are independent of the subjectivity of Trump voters. Yeah?
I think it's important to keep in mind, though, also that people's intersubjective states can also reinforce these institutions.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. And that's, when we get to the theory of ideology, that's the whole point of it. It's to understand how subjectivities are formed and how they either reproduce or undermine, because they can contradict, the institutions in which they're embedded. Right. No, absolutely. So I do think subjectivity is important. I'm not for a moment saying it's irrelevant. And the standpoint epistemology problem bears most heavily on that question. But I don't think it implies that we can't have objective scientific knowledge as well. And furthermore, that there isn't a method involved in the use of the term science that differentiates it from simply knowledge generated by experience, per se, kind of unmediated by science. This also bears on another very tricky and delicate question, which has become very hot in recent years, which sometimes goes under the notion of the epistemologies of the South. That is, when we're talking about folk knowledge and knowledge of indigenous peoples. Sometimes the word knowledge is used in the plural, the knowledges of indigenous people. I have engaged in endless debates with a very close friend, Boaventura Santos, who's a Portuguese sociologist, very prominent in Latin America, particularly in Brazil, who has written extensively about epistemologies of the sounds. And he is very insistent that there is absolutely no special standing of what he considers the European form of knowledge, which goes under the name science, that it really has no special standing relative to the knowledge that's generated through indigenous knowledge practices. I strongly disagree with that view. What is correct about the view of the non-privileged role of science is that scientific claims should never be posed arrogantly. We should certainly try to appropriate what is valuable from the knowledge that is organic to a culture, especially since much knowledge generated by indigenous people is actually produced in proto-scientific ways. I mean, after all, how did knowledge of herbal medicines develop in an indigenous culture if it wasn't through a kind of proto-scientific trial and error where people observed the consequences of infusions made from bark that reduced headaches, and thus the ingredient which became aspirin in pharmaceutical world was well known to Native Americans in their indigenous, you know, medicine practices. Well, they found that out through a proto-scientific process of trial and error. It wasn't formal experimentation. They didn't have placebos and all that stuff, but they learned it by observing what happens in the world. Still, I think there is a crucial difference between full-blown scientific methods and the quasi-proto-scientific methods that are observed in lots of indigenous and folk cultural contexts, and that's the problem of how do you correct your errors. The error correction process is what's really crucial to science. It's not its ability to produce certainties, it's its ability to learn from mistakes. And the way it does that is by constantly seeking to understand the mechanisms that generate the phenomena that it observes. It's the search for causal mechanisms or explanatory mechanisms that's the pivotal way that you ultimately can learn from mistakes. So trial and error is fine, and some of that can work just by observing consequences, but it can lead to mistakes. And indigenous knowledge, when it confronts novel situations, can produce horrible mistakes. That was part of the difficulty in southern Africa of getting antiretroviral drugs to be widely accepted to combat HIV/AIDS, was because it went against what indigenous knowledge believed would be the cause of these kinds of illnesses. Well, they were just wrong, and they didn't have a way of correcting their mistakes internal to their own knowledge-producing practices. Okay. To sum up, in emancipatory social science determines the choice of questions to ask. The analysis of the present realities of oppression from the point of view of emancipatory alternatives. The social science in emancipatory social science gives us a methodology for producing answers. The specification of mechanisms, the production of causal explanations, the systematic use of evidence. So we got up to Roman numeral three. I can quickly, for purposes of this videographic record, I can quickly run through this last bit, and I'll just begin the next lecture with Roman numeral four, just as a way of finishing the stage setting. Okay, well, this is all about general emancipatory critical theory. What about Marxism? I like to break down Marxism at this level of abstraction. This is still before we get to talk about particular mechanisms and capitalism, class, ideology, the state, and all that stuff. I like to think of it as having six core ideas. First, emancipatory social transformation is possible. Okay, that's one of those foundational theses we've already said. We can consciously transform social life in ways that expand the possibilities of human freedom, autonomy, flourishing, and so on. It's not, social life isn't unalterable, it's transformable through our conscious actions. Second, the agents for transformation come from within the game itself. The working class for Marxism, women for feminism, oppressed racial minorities for critical race theory. Change is not fundamentally a question of experts or elites imposing change as benevolent philosopher kings, but of oppressed people bringing about change. That's another crucial element of the Marxian variant of an emancipatory social theory, is that the agents for change, while not exclusively being the oppressed, it's not a simple view that the oppressed rise up without alliances and connections to other social categories, but that they are the central dynamic of struggle. And that's the third point. Transformation comes through struggle. There are powerful interests at stake in fundamental emancipatory change. People with privileges do not spontaneously relinquish privileges just through moral argument, just through enlightenment. Struggles for power are inherent in the project of social emancipation. It doesn't mean that enlightenment of elites don't matter. Engels, after all, was a son of a Manchester capitalist and was able to fund the writing of Capital, Marx's work in the British Museum, because of his wealth. You can enlighten elites, and they do play a role. But it is struggles over power that are central to the process of transformation. And the punchline of these three points is that oppressed people can transform the conditions of their own oppression through struggle. But, fifth point, they do so under constraints not of their choosing, to use a phrase from Marx, which can thwart their efforts. And this is why point six, knowledge is important. To effectively transform the world in an emancipatory way, we must understand the nature of the constraints themselves and how to transform them. This requires knowledge, learning. We must learn from our mistakes, and that's not easy. It's extremely easy to learn the wrong lessons from failure, from failures of struggles. It requires concepts, theory, intellectual skills in order to learn the right lessons from the struggles we have in the world. Learning the wrong lessons is easy. Just as a quick example to wrap up this point, there are two possible lessons from the collapse of the Soviet Union, the end of the particular Soviet historical epoch. One is socialism is impossible. That's the lesson that Margaret Thatcher embodied in the expression, there is no alternative. Another lesson is that centralized bureaucratic command of complex economies is suboptimal and dysfunctional. If there is to be a socialist alternative to capitalism, it must take the form of, it must be decentralized and democratic in order to be dynamic. So So there are different lessons that you can learn from the failure of the command economies. One is that the effort at transforming and transcending capitalism is simply impossible. It produces perverse effects. And another is that this particular form of transformation with the particular institutional design is incapable of advancing the possibilities of human emancipation. But other designs are not ruled out accordingly. Okay, that's our introduction. I'll wrap this up at the beginning of the next lecture. Also, on Monday, we will constitute our mentoring groups. Because we spent so much time with preliminary stuff today, I thought it would be better just to put that off till next week. See you then.